Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from John Russell, Dan Friedel, and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us the next part in our series on America's presidents. But first, here is John Russell.
At the Aquarium of the Pacific in California, the penguins have something in common with bird keeper Sarah Mandel's cats. Both animals like games on a tablet computer. I had actually purchased this game in the App Store for my cats, said Mandel. Then she wanted to see if the aquarium's penguins would like the game as much as her cats did. Mandel asked her supervisor if she could show the game to the birds. He laughed at me, she said. But the penguins did show an interest in the tablet computer with the cat game, Mandel said. I showed him, and he was pretty shocked. Mandel said the penguins like playing with the electronic device as much as people do. She explained how the tablet helps her care for the penguins.
So while they're kind of hanging out here, I can look at their flippers, I can make sure everything's good and healthy, and I can even sneak a scale right underneath where Lily's standing.
Penguins are not the only animals that have used tablet computers. At Zoo Atlanta, in the American state of Georgia, orangutans, gorillas, and sun bears have also worked with the technology. In Britain, a group of researchers have shown touchscreen tablets to parrots and tortoises. With the parrots, the researchers use tablets to see how the birds explore and react to something new. The touchscreens helped researchers study how tortoises learn to move around a space. Anna Wilkinson is a researcher at the University of Lincoln. She explained that a tortoise's neck length is a sign of whether the tortoise is comfortable in its surroundings. The longer the neck, the more at ease the animal is. While working with the screen, Wilkinson described the tortoise's neck as nice and long.
So touchscreens are fantastic because they give you a lot of flexibility. You can present animals with all sorts of different stimuli. They're also incredibly good because you can remove humans from the equation.
Wilkinson added that she used the electronic device to study other animals, including dogs. Sarah Mandel explained that people can be less dependable than a computer when providing help to animals, such as feeding them at a set time. She noted that humans can also distract the animals in a way that machines do not. Researchers said the animals have short attention spans and become tired easily. Like humans, Mandel said, the younger penguins are more interested in the game on the tablet. The older penguins quickly lose interest. I'm John Russell.
American civil liberties groups want politicians to stop blocking people from their social media accounts. And those politicians include President Donald Trump. The American Civil Liberties Union, known as the ACLU, filed a lawsuit against the governor of the state of Maine. The group also sent warning letters to the congressional members from the state of Utah. That comes after the ACLU filed lawsuits against the governors of Kentucky and Maryland in early August. In July, a free speech organization connected with Columbia University in New York City sued President Trump. The president often uses Twitter to communicate with the American people. But some Twitter users say they have been blocked by Trump for sending tweets he did not like. Those people can no longer send messages to Trump on Twitter. That action raises questions about what elected officials can do on their social media pages. In the past, politicians may have held public meetings to learn the concerns of voters. Now, however, they use Facebook and Twitter to have online conversations with voters. Anna Thomas is a spokeswoman for the ACLU of Utah. She said, "Voters see their representatives as available on Twitter and Facebook. They're hungry for opportunities to express their opinions," she said. "That includes people who disagree with public officials." The officials targeted by the lawsuits and warnings so far are all Republicans. They say they are blocking people who post hateful and violent content, spam, and off-topic comments. Matt Whitlock is a spokesman for Orrin Hatch, a U.S. senator from Utah. He said people are only blocked after they violate rules. Whitlock said Hatch's Facebook page should not be used as a platform for offensive content or misinformation. Katie Fallow is a lawyer at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University in New York City. Her organization filed the lawsuit against Trump last month. She said politicians who choose to use social media can't pick and choose who they hear from. U.S. courts have not heard cases like these before. But one legal expert said the free speech advocates like the ACLU probably will be able to make a stronger case than the politicians. Erwin Chemerinsky is the head of the law school at the University of California, Berkeley. He said the officials may be able to block followers only if they are blocking supporters and critics alike. "It's got to be content neutral," he said. While the question of whether politicians can block people from their social media pages may seem minor, one expert says it is quite important. Amanda Shanner works for the Information Society Project at Yale University's Law School. With more of the political discussion happening online, she said, "It's more important that we know what these rules are." I'm Dan Friedel.
I'm
Scientists in Oregon successfully fixed a disease-carrying gene in human embryos. It was the first time this has been done. This small effort could be a big step in preventing inherited or gene-related diseases. A research team at Oregon Health and Science University edited out a gene that causes a heart problem and kills young people. Their work was published in the journal Nature. Dr. Paula Amato is one of the scientists who worked on the study. She explained how it happened. The team used sperm from a man who carries the heart-damaging gene. They injected his sperm into eggs and, at the same time, injected a gene editing tool called CRISPR-Cas9. The CRISPR acts like scissors, cutting out the defective DNA. What happened next is surprising. The embryos then fixed the DNA themselves, replacing the damaged part without more help from the scientists. Amato says the gene defect correction rate was high, about 70% of the time. She says their success is proof that it can be done.
It's very preliminary at this point, but the potential is huge. But obviously, much more research needs to be done before it moves to clinical trials.
With 10,000 gene defects that cause disease, there would be no shortage of ones that could be fixed. But scientists are a long way from knowing how this would affect a baby.
The biggest thing is safety. We don't know if this truly would be safe in, if we ever tried it to establish a pregnancy and produce a baby. But that's the biggest ethical concern in my mind.
Safety and ethics are also on top of Dr. George Daly's mind. He is a stem cell scientist and the dean of Harvard Medical School. Daly was not involved in the study, but he calls it a remarkable story. Daly says if safety concerns are taken care of, the question we are left with is, should we do it, and for whom?
I tend to believe that for certain rare instances where we're trying to prevent a devastating genetic disease, that this could be indeed, if in the long run proven safe, could be a very useful and life-affirming application of medical technology.
But Daly says this technology should not be used for enhancing or improving human capabilities. That is what some call designer babies, parents creating features they want in babies. Concerned that some doctors might abuse gene editing, Daly says there should be independent supervision by professional groups to observe this work. But based on just this one study, he says it is far too early to use it in any way for making babies. For now, people wanting to avoid passing on a bad gene sometimes have embryos created in fertility clinics. Those embryos are checked, and only the ones without the bad gene are used to attempt pregnancy through so-called in vitro fertilization process. Marcy Donofsky says
in vitro fertilization avoids inherited diseases. She is with the Center for Genetics and Society in California. She is speaking out against the new gene editing.
This is not a technique that treats or cures anyone. It's not really a medical technique at all. It's about creating new human beings that have their traits determined and engineered.
She says because of its high cost, it would only be available to wealthy people, creating another kind of inequality in the country. Lori Zoloth is the dean of University of Chicago Divinity School. She says many religions see human babies as a gift from God. From some religions, there arises a concern that controlling evolution in this way gives human beings too much power over what is God's creation, she says. Arthur Kaplan supports the idea of the gene editing technique. An expert in bioethics, Kaplan heads the Medical Ethics Division at New York University School of Medicine. He says it would be good to do away with genetic diseases like cystic fibrosis, hemophilia, and sickle cell anemia. These are examples of terrible genetic diseases for which there is no cure. And, Kaplan adds, not all genetic diseases can be eliminated by using IVF.
Finding ways to prevent them from being passed on to one's children and grandchildren would be a wonderful achievement, one that I find it hard to argue has any objection in terms of eliminating disability and premature death and stopping something that's plagued all of mankind forever, inheriting genetic diseases.
It is not known how permanently changing the genes may affect the following generations. Changing genes may produce children that are sick, much like the sheep Dolly. She was cloned in 1996, made from a genetic copy of another sheep, but she grew sick and died early. Kaplan says history tells us to wait and see how the technique works in animals first.
Let's see how they turn out after a few years, and then we'll start to get excited about using this technology to really prevent disease in people. Then we can really argue about whether it's better to screen the embryos and throw them away or fix them.
The U.S. is not alone in doing this scientific research. Kaplan says other countries like China, Britain, and Singapore are also editing or planning to edit genes. I'm Anne Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about William McKinley. He took office in 1897 and was re-elected in 1900. He led the United States into the 20th century. One way to think of McKinley is as a transition president. In the 1800s, lawmakers were mostly concerned with how the country was growing in North America. But during McKinley's government, the U.S. looked beyond its borders. Congress declared war on Spain, the first time the U.S. had fought a European power since the War of 1812 against Britain. The U.S. also took control of overseas territories, annexed Hawaii, and tried to regulate the world's trade with China. Some historians say President McKinley himself wanted the U.S. to increase its international influence. Others argue that he was just answering the country's mood at the time. Either way, his presidency is often defined by the country's rise as an imperial power. McKinley was the sixth president to come from the state of Ohio. He was the seventh of eight children. Historians describe his childhood as loving and fun. His father owned a small iron factory. His mother raised her children to be honest and polite. McKinley was a hard-working student. He briefly attended Allegheny College in Pennsylvania, but he did not have the money to finish his education there. A few years after leaving that school, he volunteered for the Army on the side of the Union in the Civil War. He served under a man who would later become president himself, Rutherford B. Hayes. The two stayed close throughout their lives. After the war ended, McKinley studied law, became involved in Republican Party politics, married, and had two daughters. His wife, Ida, was an energetic, well-educated young woman from a wealthy family. For a while, she had worked in her father's bank. But Ida McKinley's health began to suffer. She was struck by seizures. Then her mother died. A few months later, her younger daughter died while still an infant. Ida McKinley clung to her older daughter, but the little girl soon developed a fever disease, and she died too. William and Ida McKinley were never the same. Ida McKinley remained sick her entire life. She spent most of her hours in a small rocking chair, sewing. William McKinley paid great attention to her. He organized his schedule to spend time near her, even as his political success grew. In time, McKinley served in Congress and as the governor of Ohio. He was known as a likable person and a skilled politician. His Republican Party nominated him on the first ballot at their convention. A few months later, voters elected McKinley into office in a landslide. He became the country's 25th president. When McKinley took office, the U.S. was just coming out of a severe economic depression. His government quickly approved a high protective tariff to help struggling workers. In general, his administration also permitted the growth of big business. But most of McKinley's attention as president was devoted to foreign policy. The main issue was Cuba. At that time, Spain controlled the island. Cubans revolted, and Spanish forces used violence and detainments to crush the rebellion. In the U.S., many Americans denounced the events in Cuba. They wanted McKinley and his government to intervene. At first, President McKinley was unwilling. He tried to use diplomacy. He even ordered a U.S. ship into Spanish waters near Havana to show his continued support of Spain. But the ship, called the Maine, exploded. Americans believed the Spanish were responsible. Relations between the two countries worsened fast. Spain declared war. the U.S. Congress answered in kind. For 100 days, U.S. and Spanish forces fought in Cuba and other areas under Spanish control. The war quickly turned in the Americans' favor. When the Spanish-American War ended with the Treaty of Paris in 1898, the U.S. took control of Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines from Spain. Cuba was made independent. However, the U.S. continued to occupy the island for several more years. Not everyone approved of the actions of McKinley's government. Even some members of Congress warned against the U.S. becoming an imperial power. But a majority of voters approved of McKinley as a victorious commander-in-chief. They also noted that the U.S. economy was getting stronger. In 1900, McKinley won re-election. As it turned out, McKinley's second term in office was short. In September, only 6 months after his swearing in, the president was receiving visitors at a fair in the city of Buffalo, New York. One of the visitors in line was a 28-year-old man named Leon Czolgosz. His family was from Poland, but he lived in the city of Detroit, Michigan. He had worked in a factory, but at the time was unemployed. He supported the idea of anarchy, no government at all. When McKinley reached to shake the young man's hand, Czolgosz shot the president twice in the stomach. Although injured, McKinley spoke to his guards. He told them not to hurt the shooter, and he expressed concern about how his wife would feel when she learned he had been shot. Quickly, McKinley was taken to a hospital. Doctors predicted that he would survive. And for a few days, McKinley seemed to improve. But the wound became infected, and 8 days after the attack, McKinley died. The president's murderer did not say he was sorry for his act. He defended it, saying McKinley was an enemy of working people. Within a few weeks of the shooting, Czolgosz was tried, found guilty, and executed. Both the nation and the world mourned when McKinley died. He had been one of the country's most popular presidents in many years. He left behind the beginning of what some called an American empire. He also marked a change in the U.S. presidency. When he first took office in the 19th century, most presidents acted primarily as administrators. But President McKinley began to act in ways that are more like a modern president. He prepared remarks to give to the media. He traveled across the country speaking to voters. He used the power of his office to direct the armed forces. McKinley laid the groundwork, but he did not completely change the presidency. He left that to the even more famous man who followed him into the White House. After McKinley's death, his vice president, Theodore Roosevelt, took office and truly brought the country into modern times. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.